This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show, episode number 857. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and I want to thank you so much for joining me today. We are going to do the intro portion with one of our investment counselors, Carrie, who's back on the show, and I promise I'm going to let her talk this time. Carrie, you got to do some talking, okay? So I'm going to shut up. Just butt in, you know, you got to just take control. And see, Carrie, you're too nice. That's the thing. You're too polite. And our guest today will be James Ledbetter. He is the editor of Inc. magazine. He's a contributor for Reuters, Time magazine, and The Village Voice. And the guy's just got a great history. He's the author of a couple of books. His most recent one is One Nation Under Gold. And you might be thinking, well, you know, here you go. Why are you talking about gold, Jason? This is a real estate show. I'm telling you, folks, even though I am completely not a gold bug, you've heard my story. I don't want to say I'm like anti-gold. I'm just not pro-gold, okay? I'm kind of neutral. I think that most of these investments, precious metals, stocks, pretty much everything except income property and your own business are pretty darn lame because they're not multidimensional. And income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world because it's a multidimensional asset class. But I think you'll find the interview with James, who is, by the way, not a gold bug either. He's acting as a journalist when he wrote the book. And I think you'll find it to be interesting because, you know, it's historically, it's a big deal. It's an important commodity and an important form of money. So, Carrie, welcome back. So we want to jump in. You've been doing a really nice job of cataloging all of these questions we're getting from our AirPod contest. You can win some Apple AirPods if you go to jasonhartman.com/contest. We're giving those away. As a podcast listener, you will love this product. If you don't have these AirPods yet, there's like a 6-week wait for them. They are phenomenal. I love this product. It's probably the best product Apple's done in 5 years or so. So we're giving some of those away, and we'll wrap up the contest real soon and announce the winner. But as you have been entering the contest, you've been posting some great questions and comments, which we're going to endeavor to address on the show. So Carrie, one of our show guests and longtime client who just got up between he and his wife, Sue, to their 20-home Fannie Mae Freddie Mac limit. They've now got 20 properties. That is Captain Gary Pinkerton, who has been on the show before. He has a question here in your document. Why don't you tell us what his question is, and that's going to segue very well into another related topic. Go ahead.
One of the largest risks to investing success is not doing a good deal with a bad person. So the challenge Gary's had is determining in the good times when everyone's making the money, who the actual bad people are. They show themselves when as Warren Buffett says, the tide goes out. So his question was, what have we found are the telling signs that we can highlight to find a bad person?
That's a great question, Carrie. And, you know, I have long said I would rather be in a B market, like, you know, not the best real estate market. I'm talking geographically, like not the best city, but I'd rather have an A team in a B market, in a B city, than the other way around, a B team in an A market, because the team is the most important thing. This whole thing lives or dies on the quality of, you know, not only the properties, but the provider, the local market specialist that we pick. And that's why that's why we're not doing deals in foreign countries. I mean, I don't want to say we never will. I just haven't found one that works, you know. We're not doing this crappy stuff in these third world developing countries where there's no regulation and you have no recourse whatsoever. And there's just a lot of promoters promoting a lot of crap out there. But even in the U.S., you know, there's a lot of crooks. And what happens, like Gary's comment about the tide going out, is when the money is just flowing like crazy and the market is crazy, that's when screening becomes a big thing. I remember when I was 20 years old and I was taking real estate classes at Century 21's corporate office in Anaheim, California. And Dennis McKenzie, who was the author of several of the real estate books, was just this great teacher. And he talked about that. He said, in a booming market, your biggest job is screening. You know, it's screening the people you're dealing with because every flake comes out of the woodwork. You know, in a recessionary time when it's a more of a buyer's market than a seller's market, then, you know, only the strong survive. Okay. And that, well, not completely. Sometimes the weak survive too and the unethical, but mostly, you know, so screening is the big job. And Carrie, that is what you do.
Yes. Yes. On a regular basis, I am constantly following up with providers that we have, some from the past, some new ones, and just rescreening and making sure, you know, nothing comes up that would be a big red flag, which we found lately in one of the providers we were about to take on.
Yeah, yeah. So this, tell us, which market is this? We're going to save them by not getting sued again and not mentioning their name, but tell us about this company, this XYZ real estate company and where they're located.
So XYZ is located in Toledo, Ohio. And we thought they were a unique provider. They had some good, strong returns, you know, good credibility out there. And they were, you could only do cash deals, though. They weren't financed. So that was one kind of, okay, unique idea that we could bring on for those cash buyers. Not your ultimate ideal buyer, but, you know, just another option. So we said, okay, let's give it a try and let's get it out there. But towards the end of, you know, just about to launch them, we were going through the routine of, you know, how do we close the investor, you know, what's the process? We'll offer referrals for inspection reports. And right away they said, no, there's no inspection reports. They buy the turnkey property as is.
Are you freaking kidding? That's unbelievable. Yeah.
And just you had to get your inspection report after you closed the property. And so that was a huge red flag that, you know.
What? I mean, do these, can these people actually say this crap with a straight face? I mean, you know, inspection report after you close. The whole point of an inspection is to be a good buyer and not make a mistake and do it before you close. Obviously, I mean, that seems so obvious, right?
Right.
But these
right.
people really with a straight face were saying that our buyers were not allowed to do inspections before buying. They, in other words, they wanted to pull the wool over their eye. And by the way, Carrie, this is one of the things our listeners need to understand. Whenever you have someone who will only do cash deals, that should be an alert. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying buyer, you know, that old Latin phrase, caveat emptor, I think is how you say it. Buyer, let the buyer beware. Well, if it's a cash deal, the buyer needs to be more aware because when you have a lender involved in the transaction, that's sort of another check and balance, right? They're going to do an appraisal. You know, they're going to have some requirements. They're not going to protect you from everything. I mean, it's, you know, it's not your lender's job to do your home inspection, okay? But you're going to have some, you know, additional safeguard there, an additional check and balance. Whereas if it's cash, it's just, you know, the Wild West. I mean, there's not going to be any lender's title insurance policy. So, you know, it's more possible you could have title problems. It's, you know, there's not going to be an appraisal that, and appraisers inspect properties. So, it's not a home inspection. There is a major difference, but you know, the appraiser does a basic visual inspection, just looking at the house. And then when they say something like this, like, don't have a home inspection, you got to just instantly think, what are they hiding? That's just absurd. Frickin' ridiculous. I'm mad.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. What kind of secrets do they have? And you're not going to find out as an investor out of state. You know, that's what the lender, as Jason said, the lender, the appraiser, the inspector, they're going to find that stuff out for you. And being not sight unseen, you have no idea. It's just too risky.
Absolutely.
Way too risky.
It is. It's way too risky. And I mean, the fact that they would even put this in a document is beyond absurd. Okay. Let's just look at this. Let's just look at this email you sent me. I got to blow up the screen because it's on Voxer here. But seriously though, this house is one of the best deals of 2017. It's absolutely stunning. 3-bedroom, blah, blah, blah. And Carrie, is there anything we should share with our audience out of this image? You know the one I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I have it in front of me. Well, it's just the language isn't up to standards for what our investors, our clients would want
this
to
is,
see.
Oh, I love what they say. This is effing, okay, the F word, A-class deal. And in my opinion, we're 10,000 below market, right?
Right. Yep. That's the same one. Yeah. So it's just,
it doesn't look like S like shit.
Yeah. So God. A few explicit words in there that just, it's just not up to standards. And those were the red flags that just stopped it all, that we just had to halt this and pull it from a potential provider.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. And one of the things that I just love about you and the rest of our team, Carrie, is that, you know, you really all take the long-term view. You know, you're not like these quick buck salespeople that are certainly exist in the world, you know? And I think one of the things that might be beneficial about our company culture that makes that true is that you guys have to deal with all the problems. So, you know, because the investment counselors are the ones that have to follow up. And when the client calls and has problems, you're doing kind of that customer service role, if you will. And I think that kind of ties the two together. Certainly not the most efficient thing for the business, but you know, I think it's a good thing to have, to put the investment counselors at stake, if you will, in the client's success.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we know you're out there, you're coming to us and you're going to buy a property. So it's just to find you the right property. We're not just going to throw you something that, you know, in a year or two, you're going to just come back and growling at us. You know, you're going to buy it. We know it. So we want to help you the right way.
Yeah. So we're property agnostic. We are area agnostic and we are local market specialist agnostic. I do want to make one distinction on what I said about cash deals earlier, and that is that if you do a cash deal with a cash-only local market specialist, that's when I want the alert sign to go up. If you do a cash deal with a local market specialist that, you know, normally lets you finance the deals, okay, that's a different thing. That's not a big cause for concern. It's a little bit of one because just remember, there's no safeguards. Like no one's going to tell you, you know, and I've done this myself. I mean, you know, I try to admit my own mistakes. Okay. And, you know, be transparent about them. I've made many of them. I have closed on properties that I purchased with cash with no insurance. No one alerted me. You know, I just wasn't used to it. I forgot about it, basically. And if you don't have a lender, the lender is not going to say, hey, that's a condition of closing, right? If you're buying with cash, they're just going to close the deal for you, okay? And I have literally lost a few sleepless nights where I thought, oh my God, I have this property, like first thing in the morning, you know, if it's an East Coast property, I got it 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. I'm up because it's 9 a.m. there and I'm going to get an insurance policy. My God, I can't believe I did that. What a screw up. Like literally, if someone slipped and fell on that property or if the property burnt down that night, I'd be, that's it. You know, I'm dead. You know, I'm just paying for it. And so that can happen on a cash deal, right? There's no appraisal. There's no value safeguard. So you got to be a little more concerned about, is the value really there? Okay. Because there's no appraisal. Not to say that appraisals are by any means perfect. They're, massively flawed. I mean, appraisers appraise properties too high and too low all the time. Okay, it's not perfect by any means. But, you know, it's something, right? It's an additional check. So you got to be careful on cash deals.
Well, this one particular provider that we ended up passing, they did have around the $100,000 deals, you know, where lenders could take that property, but other providers might have it under $60,000, where you do have to do the cash deal and you can't get a lender to finance that. So that's one thing also that they were pretty higher end deals to not make it just cash, but we could have financed it.
Yeah, let me elaborate on that for you, because I'm not sure people know what you mean. So on the really inexpensive lower end properties, a lot of times those are sold for cash just because they're sort of not worth financing sometimes for necessarily the buyer and the lender. A lot of lenders have minimum loan amounts. It's like, look, you know, they're not going to make a loan for under $50,000. So if the house is 60 and you put, you know, 25% down, well, the loan amount's way below $50,000. Okay. And it's just not worth it for them. I mean, you know, like a car loan is bigger than 50 grand a lot of times, right? So a lot of those lower end properties are sold for cash. But again, we've talked about the myth of the $40,000 house too. So that's another topic we won't go into today. But yeah, good stuff. Well, Carrie, thank you for sharing this. Gary also made a comment. Do you want to share that with our audience?
Sure. Yeah. So Gary's comment is, Jason is an educator at heart and has proven again and again that he is a principled, ethical person that maintains a consistent message. He sticks to his 10+ commandments. So many podcast and radio show hosts blow in the direction of the individual paying to be on the show or that is sponsoring the show. Awesome content, great education, incredible person.
Gary, you're my biggest fan. I love you. Thank you. That's awesome. That's awesome. But you know, yes, you got to be consistent and you got to believe in something. I think the problem, you know, I remember a long time ago, one of my early mentors, Dennis Waitley, I remember listening to his tapes. Yes, they were tapes, cassette tapes, that used to, you know, become tangled and the tape used to come out of the machine and the problems we used to have, Carrie, before your time. You do remember cassette tapes, right? You're not that young.
Right? I do. Yeah, okay. Of course. All yeah. Right. Boys to Men.
Boys to Men on cassette. Huh? Okay.
Yep.
Do you remember? I bet you don't know what an 8-track tape is, though.
No. No.
You don't even know what I'm talking about, do you?
I'm trying.
So that was like this bigger cassette tape that you would put into your car. And it was like big. It was like the size of a an old VHS videotape, you know, or the size of a book, a small book. I mean, it was ridiculous. Oh, wow. 8-track tapes. Yeah. Yeah. I even remember those. What was I going to say about that? I don't know where I was going with that. Age tapes. Oh, Dennis Waitley. He said, you've got to stand for something. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And, you know, you got to have some core belief system. And that's what the 10 commandments, or as Gary said, the 10 plus, because now we actually have 20, really help you do as an investor. They help you stand for something. You have an actual philosophy, something that's grounded. You have a real outline and a real methodology. And, you know, those are sort of your foundational principles. And you go from there. Of course, there's more to it than that, but that's your foundation. And it's, you know, it's something that I think is just critical. So, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us. Before we get to our guest, let's tell people about some of the stuff we're thinking about, okay? And I'm talking about all Hawaii. Right. Remember our messages back and forth yesterday about Hawaii?
Yes.
Okay, so
no, I don't.
Oh, you don't.
Why don't you explain?
Oh, were you not in this conversation? Maybe it was just Sarah and I. I don't know. Okay, I'm attributing it to you. I don't think you were on that chat group. It was with Sarah. So we're thinking about doing our first event in Hawaii. Yeah. Prophets in Paradise. Maybe we'll call it Prophets in Paradise. That'd be a good name. So, you know, a lot of our clients in Asia and, you know, that side of the world, and we have a lot in Hawaii who are listening. Hi, Hawaiian. Aloha. Not hi. Hello, aloha to our Hawaiian clients. You know, we just thought it'd be nice to go to Hawaii. We've been talking about doing that for the Venture Alliance Mastermind Group. And heck, maybe we'll just do a seminar there. So stay tuned for that. You know, we might do it. We might actually do it. So keep that in mind. But in the meantime, yeah, wouldn't it be cool? Go to jasonhartman.com/contest and enter to win some Apple AirPods. And let's get to our guest, James Ledbetter, editor of Inc. Magazine. And Carrie, thanks so much for joining me on the intro. Here's James. It's my pleasure to welcome James Ledbetter to the show. He is founding editor of Slate's financial site, The Big Money, former opinion editor at Reuters, and editor at Inc. Magazine, Inc.com, Time, and The Village Voice, author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Great Depression, A Diary, and the new book, One Nation Under Gold, How One Precious Metal Has Dominated the American Imagination for Four Centuries. James, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Jason.
My pleasure. Give us a sense of geography. Where are you located?
New York City, Manhattan.
Fantastic. So the new book is quite interesting, and I just want to say to our audience to maybe start, because we were talking a little bit off air about this, you are not a gold bug, and you don't really have an agenda. You're a journalist, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've written this book, One Nation Under Gold, about the American obsession with this particular metal. That doesn't mean that I own it. It doesn't mean that I advocate that people own it. Also true that I am not saying people should not own it. My point is more historical, that gold, for better or worse, is written into the American DNA. It's in our Constitution. When you have the discovery of gold in California in 1848, you create all of a sudden, and kind of from nothing, this sense that the West Coast is just as important, if not more important, than the East Coast. For a brief time, the San Francisco Stock Exchange becomes more valuable than the New York Stock Exchange during this period. Globally, suddenly, this kind of, you know, quasi-bankrupt former colony called the United States becomes a global center of power, of finance, because of gold. And that, again, for better or worse, is written into who we are as a country. And you can't erase it. You can't quite, at any given point, make sense of it. But that's who we are. And that's the thesis of my book.
Fantastic. So, you know, you write about something that I guess no one has ever really written about before. It's something that happened under the Johnson administration in the 60s. Now, we all know, you know, that Nixon finally closed the gold window in 1971. And, you know, we'll talk about that. But yeah, Let's go kind of in a chronological fashion and tell us about what happened with LBJ.
So, Jason, let me set this up a little bit. In the post-war period, you have what's globally known as the Bretton Woods system. In this system, the dollar is fixed to gold at the price of $35 per ounce of gold. Every other major currency in the world, the franc, the Deutschmark, the yen, is fixed to the dollar. So it's all kind of tied to gold, and the bands in which these currencies can trade is very, very narrow. This works really well. It works arguably too well. The development of Western Europe and Japan in the 50s and 60s creates a system in which you have so many dollars and so many dollar-denominated securities out there in the world that if they were all to be redeemed at the treasury window, where they're supposedly exchangeable at the rate of $35 an ounce, you'd have no more gold. That's a problem. That's a big problem. You can either say, hey, we're not going to exchange money, which is a disaster, or let it all come in, another disaster. And there is really no way out of this. And so the increasingly what you find, if you look through the files of Washington at this time, is a kind of panic. The Johnson administration thinks it can come up with a solution, which is basically, let's find gold where it has never been found before. And because it's 1965, they call it, what else would they call it? Operation Goldfinger, right? Named after the James Bond movie that was hugely, hugely popular at the time. Operation Goldfinger, top secret. No one has ever written about this because the documents have just become declassified as I published my book. Has three components. One, let's use state-of-the-art technology to find gold where it has never been found before. So is there gold in meteorites that hit the Earth? Is there gold in seawater? Is there gold in animal brains? Is there gold in deer antlers? I mean, honestly, you can't make this stuff up. And the answer is, well, yeah, kind of. There's some. If once the technology gets sophisticated enough to be able to measure parts per million, parts per billion, you can find traces of gold in almost anything, in your pencil, in your hair, whatever. But when the price is fixed at $35 an ounce, it's meaningless, right? It would cost you a gazillion dollars to get the gold out of deer antlers. So it's sort of silly. Second thing, kind of like fracking, we know that there's gold in, you know, mine X in Nevada or New Mexico or Arizona. But we've got the majority of it out of the ground at $35 an ounce. There's a good chance that there's more gold further down into the mine, but we can't get there using conventional explosives. What if we put a nuclear bomb in the ground and blew all the gold up and leached it out? I mean, this was...
Yeah, if you're an environmentalist, you can't be a gold bug at the same time. Those are contradictory.
In the mid-60s, you know, people weren't really thinking about environment. By the time actually get to experimenting with this, you know, and by the way, many experiments along these lines were conducted. Finally, you know, cooler heads prevailed, but it was a very serious line of inquiry. And the third aspect of Goldfinger was, well, can we make gold out of base metals? I mean,
yeah, alchemy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the centuries-old alchemy quest. And the answer is yes, it can be done. The head of the Atomic Energy Commission, Glenn Seaborg, a great scientist for whom multiple elements are named after, he actually does it later in 1980, kind of trying to do something else. But you take very, very thin bismuth foil, bombard it with a particle beam, and you displace some electrons, and what you're left with is, you know, a form of gold. However, and this is a big, big however, Seaborg calculates at the time that to produce gold by this method would cost approximately $1 quadrillion per ounce, right? So it's off the chart.
So it can be done. It's just not worth doing
yet.
It's
so not worth doing.
Until the technology gets better or the price comes down.
Jason, here is evidence of a monetary system that has gone off the rails. The logic, if you need to find gold this badly, then the idea of tying your monetary system to gold is clearly wrong. Like, something needed to happen to break it. It ultimately happens under Nixon. It might have happened under Johnson, but it had to happen one way or another.
Okay. So what is the result of Operation Goldfinger then? Basically, leave it to Nixon to close the gold window in 71?
It kind of fizzles out. Like,
yeah, okay.
Now, you could make an argument in the private sector that some of the methods that they deployed actually rejuvenate the private gold industry. And by the way, by the 1980s, the otherwise dormant United States gold mining industry has a renaissance. It's fantastic. I mean, it doesn't become a world leader, but it's way, way off of the doldrums that it was in the 1960s. And so, to some degree, Operation Goldfinger succeeds in terms of inspiring the private sector, but basically it all just fizzles. But more importantly, the relationship between the dollar and gold finally breaks down in 1971. August 15th, 1971, Nixon kind of quietly interrupts an episode of Bonanza on a Sunday night and says, we're gonna temporarily suspend the relationship between the dollar. Well, temporarily, it's been more than 50 years. So I think it's kind of permanent.
Anytime the government tells you a tax is temporarily, you know, or any monetary thing that's going to benefit them, it's never temporary.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it turns out to be permanent. Yeah. And
okay,
again,
so James, yeah, I got some questions for you because I want to kind of focus this discussion as to, number one, the listeners need to know why this discussion is important to them, right? So, you know, gold, I am definitely not a gold bug. I think it's a totally flawed asset class. It's one dimensional. It's, you know, I like investing in real estate, okay? Income producing real estate. That's a multidimensional, wonderful investment. But you know, gold is a good measuring stick. It's something that, you know, throughout history, people have used as this measuring stick. And it's interesting to see the rise of all these cryptocurrencies now. And I'm sure you've probably covered that, or at least, you know, looked at it a little bit. And, you know, where is this going? I mean, for example, just a broad question here, and we can circle back to, you know, the book more specifically, but what does the future look like? Does the future look inflationary, deflationary, or is it kind of, you know, just stagnation? What are we looking at?
It's a great question. And, you know, people of a certain age, I'm in my 50s. I grew up in the 1970s when inflation as officially measured was kind of out of control.
Oh, totally.
And worldwide. I mean, stagflation, you know, massive inflation. And some of this was a hangover from the Nixon shock of taking the dollar off gold. By comparison, in the larger economies, we seem to, you know, knock on wood, thanks to, I think, the monetary policy of our big banks, inflation is more or less under control. I mean, it's 2%, 3% in any given year. But
that's understated. We all know that. But, you know, it's still relatively low.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, compared to Argentina, or compared to what it was when
or
when
compared to Jimmy Carter.
Right. But, well, yeah. Exactly. Well, exactly. And so under those circumstances, the desire to move to gold should be and kind of, you know, arguably is very understated. Like, who cares, right? If we're not having massive inflation, what is the impetus to move toward gold? And yet, because of the Great Recession, because of the obvious shortcomings of the current monetary system, there is always going to be a constituency that says the solution is gold, gold standard. Now, I don't agree with that, but the point of writing my book, One Nation Under Gold, is to try and understand, what are these people saying? Why do they believe what they believe? And what does that have to do with our DNA, our history as a nation? What is the connection between this bit of political rhetoric and kind of who we are? That's the book that I've written.
Yeah, yeah. So the future, it sounds like you think, is inflationary, right?
I do. I mean, in the sense that I don't believe that there's going to be any return to a gold standard. It's simply too complicated, and also it would be massively disruptive. Let's just think it through. If we were to if you and I had a deadline tomorrow at 8 a.m., we have to restore the United States dollar to a gold standard. What would the valuation be? Like today's market price? An average over, I don't know, 3 years, 5 years.
I don't think you could do it.
You couldn't
with all of the credit in circulation,
exactly.
Not just the money supply, but the credit supply.
Exactly.
Gold would be worth like $1 billion an ounce.
Well,
it's impossible.
And imagine what that would do to the global economy. So it's not really an option, and yet it remains politically an attractive. Kind of glittering prize for a certain sector of mostly Republican voting population, and I find that fascinating. And again, it's almost uniquely American. Like if you go to France or you go to Japan, you're not going to find 20% of the population that thinks that they should have a gold standard. But in America, it's kind of still really attractive, even though, or maybe because, it's never going to happen. And that's really what drove me to write the book, One Nation Under Gold.
Yeah, very interesting. So you wrote that other book about the Great Depression. Are there any lessons? Of course there are. I mean, this is like a rhetorical question, really. But, you know, what lessons, maybe I should say, should we learn, you know, from what happened in the past?
Man, in the Depression book, my co-author, Dan Roth, who's still alive at 90 plus, it was his father's diary. Fascinating. The Great Depression, a diary. I really, really encourage readers to find a copy of it. His thing in that era was an insurance policy. That was literally the difference between, you know, starvation.
You mean an actual insurance policy. You mean insurance of your own, like savings?
I mean an actual life insurance policy that you could cash out for money. And that is how he funded his daughter's college education. That's how he got through the lean years. Now, I'm not recommending this as a 21st century
personal finance policy.
I'm not. But I really encourage people to read the book, The Great Depression and Diary. It's fantastic. But that's how he got through. You know, in terms of the 21st century, again, I'm not pro-gold, anti-gold. If people want to hold gold as part of a broader portfolio that represents, you know, less than 10% of your portfolio value, go for it. I'm in no way anti-gold. My point is that for better or worse, in America, gold brings with it all of this, as it were, baggage that we should know about if we're going to take it on either as an individual investor or as a country in terms of our currency, and that we really need to know what we're doing historically, and that most people don't know that. And that's why I wrote the book.
Interesting stuff. So tell us what's going on at Inc. Magazine. How are our businesses booming out there?
I am right now in the process of closing the September issue. Our September issue is the Inc. 500, the 500 fastest growing companies in America. It's my favorite thing to do. It's our biggest issue of the year. We come up with these great stories looking at, you know, the real engine of capitalism in the United States, which is small and growing businesses. You have to have $2 million revenue on your third year. You have to have been in business for 3 years, and it's super fun, Jason. It's my absolute favorite thing to do right now, and you'll see it all in the September issue.
So I've got a question about that. That really is a barometer on the economy. How are businesses doing? I mean, are they, you know, you've been doing Inc. 500, 5,000 for many, many years. How old is that, by the way, that count?
The franchise is about 25 years old.
So for 25 years, I mean, are these companies growing faster than they were? You know, are they growing particularly fast now? Or
yeah.
Kind of give us the, what does that tell us?
We're at the fastest pace ever, but you've put your finger on something really, really important, which is this year, political uncertainty. These companies don't know what's going to happen with healthcare. They don't know what's going to happen with Trump. We're 100 quarters into economic growth. There's got to be a recession coming anytime soon. No one knows exactly when. And one of the things that we try to do is to really focus on companies who are able to grow even through this period of tremendous uncertainty. And that's, you'll have to buy the September issue, but it's great stuff.
Yeah. It is just amazing to me, though, how innovative these entrepreneurs are. I mean, just ideas that you never thought needed until someone came along and supplied it. It's incredible.
People come up with businesses in the craziest places. There's a business in having people painting in bars. Right? Like you have a bachelor party or a bachelorette party. You take your 12 people out to a bar and they all paint and drink wine at the same time. I would never come up with that in a million years. Fidget spinners, you know, the craze of the year. All this, people are endlessly creative. And the great thing about the United States is we have a structure for our economy where these kind of crazy ideas can become businesses almost overnight. If you were in Venezuela, or if you were in France, or if you were in Japan, it could take you, you know, weeks or months to start a business.
Yeah, you know, that's, it just blows my mind that politicians in the U.S. and people in the U.S. think the U.S. should be more like Europe. Listen, I was born in Europe. I was there just about a month ago. I'm going back next week. Europe is a disaster. Okay, let me just tell you, Europe is a frickin' mess. And to think that you want to make the U.S. more like Europe, you're out of your tree. Get your head examined, please. Europe sucks. Okay, now,
but
why am I going?
Tell me what
because
you really think. Don't hold back.
It's got Europe. Europe's got great culture and you know, yeah, I know. I've never been short of an opinion.
I was just in Italy myself.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I love going there. It's cool. But like, would I want to live there and be under that economy's thumb? Do you know how hard it is to get anything done in Europe? I mean, there's like obstacles galore. The government gets in your way. Tradition gets in your way. And people live in
monopolies.
I know. Yeah.
We have quasi monopolies. We have duopolies. Like, if you're in Italy, man, you're dealing with Telecom Italia. If you're in France, you're dealing with France Telecom. Like, that's it. Like, there are no Sprints or T-Mobiles or whatever. Like, you're dealing with the government or recently devolved from government monopoly.
Or a union. Okay, going to run your life and be on strike, or you're going to have to join the union to get a job. It is pathetic. I mean, the people live in crappy little houses. They drive crappy little cars. They have crappy little stores with no selection and really high prices. I mean, it's just, there's just not enough competition. There's not a free market. It's a mess.
It's tough.
New French president says people should only have to work 32 hours a week. You know, you're going exactly the opposite way. You want your country to prosper, incentivize people to work. You know, it's just a joke. It's a disaster. Yeah.
Well, this is a little far afield from where we started, but
it is.
Jason, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise. And give out your website and tell people where they can get the book or, you know, Inc. Obviously, everybody knows about it. But
sure. You know. So onenationundergold.com, a recently launched website for my book, or just buy it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore. And, of course, Inc. Magazine at Inc.com. Please look for our Inc. 500 issue in September.
Fantastic. And James, I really loved hearing about Goldfinger. That was fantastic. And you make me want to watch the James Bond movie again after I read your book and learn more about it.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, excellent. James Ledbetter, thanks for joining us.
Jason, it's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.